Today on Windows Weekly, a lot of people are blaming the ransomware attack on Windows. Should they? Paul Thurrott is here talking about build and also the new strategy shift in Windows. Is it mobile? Is it cloud? We will find out. Plus, an update to OneDrive and OneNote on iOS. All that and a whole lot more coming up on Windows Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Windows Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Windows Weekly, episode number 518 with Paul Thurrott. Recorded Wednesday, May 17th, 2017. Future Paul. This episode of Windows Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one who has your best interest in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/windows. And by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. See what's on the menu this week and get three meals free with your first purchase and free shipping by going to blueapron.com/windows. And by Cloudflare. More than 6 million websites, apps, APIs, and SaaS companies use Cloudflare's services to weather whatever the internet throws at them. For a free online chat session with a Cloudflare support engineer, visit cloudflare.com/twit. Welcome to Windows Weekly. This is the show where we talk about all things Windows and Microsoft, and there is a lot to talk about. This show, of course, is usually hosted by Paul Thurrott and Mary Jo Foley with Leo Laporte. Leo is in Mountain View at Google I.O. or wherever Google I.O. is, and Paul is in New Orleans. He's here with me, but Mary Jo is off in Japan. You can follow her on Instagram or other social medias and see her beautiful pictures. But for now, you just have me and Paul. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
Paul from Thurrott.com needs no introduction. Paul, thank you so much for coming on this show that you regularly do this week.
Yep. I figured I've been doing it for like 10 years. What the heck? I'll show up today.
So big news this week was the ransomware attack, the WannaCry, WannaCrypt, yep. WannaDo all the bad things. That was late last week. And then earlier this week, Brad Smith, who's chief legal officer of Microsoft, he posted a blog post basically saying, kind of blaming, well, not necessarily blaming, but saying, you know, this might not have happened if the NSA and other governments didn't stockpile basically crypto weapons. And he was saying this because a lot of people were blaming Microsoft. What do you think about people right. blaming Microsoft for the ransomware attack?
Well, I mean, first of all, that's rather hilarious. I mean, there's an unfortunate side effect to this because Microsoft actually fixed the vulnerability that makes this ransomware attack possible over 2 months ago. And the issue we've always had in the Windows world is that not everybody, especially in business, updates their computers right away. And this is one of the reasons that Microsoft with Windows 10 has moved to this new model, which they call Windows as a Service, where they pretend that Windows is an online service where it's evergreen and kept updated all the time. And they deliver those updates automatically to users. So if you're in Windows 10 Home, for example, there's no way you can stop that. If you're on Windows 10 Pro, there's actually no way you can stop it if there are security updates for the most part. You can delay feature updates for some amount of time. So if everyone was on Windows 10, if everyone was following Microsoft's best practices advice for other systems, this attack would never have been possible. And blaming Microsoft is, you know, kind of interesting. In fact, retroactively, I think one of the neat things that they did, which was very unexpected, was to patch this on unsupported versions of Windows, like Windows XP, which is something they said they would never do. And I think that shows a certain seriousness about doing what they can do to fix the problem retroactively. But I know that a lot of the computers that were compromised were in the UK or in Europe or in, you know, various parts of the world. A lot of them seem to be in medical facilities like hospitals and so forth. And I don't know how this stuff works in the United States, let alone in other countries. But it seems to me that, you know, customers of these places, which are holding your most personal of data, should themselves be held to a much higher standard when it comes to data protection and security, keeping those systems up to date and so forth. A lot of those systems were running Windows XP still, which I find to be rather amazing. And then the only other thing I guess I'd say about this just off the top of my head is the Brad Smith stuff is very interesting. I think Microsoft has, over the past year or two, started to take a kind of a moral high ground when it comes to this sort of thing. They've made various calls for Digital Geneva Convention, for example, which is something he mentioned again, Brad Smith, that is, in the context of this release that they had this week. I don't know too much about this. I've been traveling, but my understanding is that since this was written, the NSA has actually come out publicly and said that they did not are not responsible for stealing the, you know, the the vulnerability or stealing the exploit, I guess it would be, that triggered this. And so maybe this is a story that is still developing in some ways as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, in many ways, Microsoft is sort of been probably they're used to being blamed for these sorts of things. I mean, it's been going on forever, like phishing yes. scams, you know, anything where, you know, you sure. click that attachment, you know, gave away your credit card to Prince in, you know, wherever, because he said that he was going to give you $100 if you gave him $50, all those things. Microsoft has been blamed for that for a long time when often yep. it's user error.
Yeah, Microsoft is in a can't win position, really, when it comes to anything like this. If you think about any of the issues people have had with Windows over the years, many of them were caused by third-party apps, by bad user behavior, whatever it might be. But ultimately, you know, as the maker of the platform, Microsoft is often held accountable for this. They've also had kind of a weird back-and-forth position when it comes to securing PCs as well. You know, this company tried to sell a product called OneCare many, many years ago, probably 15 years ago-ish, that was basically, you know, not that they would ever put it this way, but it's, you know, we ship this thing that's kind of buggy, and so we're going to now sell you this other thing that will fix the problem. You know, and I argued at that time that this just needs to be a basic part of the operating system. And it's interesting because if you flash forward to today, the capabilities that they introduced in OneCare back in that day are, in fact, built into Windows. That's what Windows Defender is today. And some of the other technologies you see, like Smart Screen and so forth, that are just basic user or computer protection technologies. But they're still kind of doing it. You know, there are advanced security features that are only available to enterprises that pay an extra fee today. And so it's sort of like, you know, in the automotive world, some of the safety features show up first in luxury cars. And so if you own a Mercedes or a Volvo or something, you were probably among the first to get, you know, airbags, side airbags, you know, various safety technologies. If you can afford to pay, you're always going to be really safe. And I think that this is one of the great equalizers in a sense. You know, it shouldn't be just people who can't afford, you know, to pay that are secure. And it's just kind of a weird issue that goes to both directions. But as far as the ransomware thing goes, I mean, I think Microsoft has done what they can do. And I think, like I said, you know, by supporting it on Windows XP, they've kind of shown a real resolve to actually do what they can and not just take a stand and say, look, we told you what we were doing and we, you know, we told you the right way to do things. I think that at least is a little bit of a warming there along those lines.
And I think, like you said, patching XP goes a long way to saying, like, hey, you know, we care. We yeah. said we weren't going to do this. It is a very old yep. operating system. So what do you say to people who say, I'm not going to update because it's going to break my system. It's going to break my company system. This won't yeah. work. That won't work. You know, what's the argument there?
It's what's the opposite of a virtuous cycle? It's kind of there's a strange relationship out in the world between IT, in the case of enterprises and the businesses that they protect, and then Microsoft is the platform maker and Windows, and then the users, you know. And there's been a real micromanagement thing in IT, and they justify it in very logical ways. And they can point to things that have happened in the past. Some of these things are really old. You know, we always talk about, you know, Windows 2000 SP2 or whatever it was that was such a disaster, but that was, you know, 2 million years ago. There were examples from last year where security patches went south and caused problems. I think that the risks of not updating a system in a timely manner outweigh, you know, the risks of the benefits, I guess, of of protecting systems in a timely manner outweigh the risks of I don't know how to say this. I think they're making a big mistake, I guess. So in other words, I don't know what the average mean time is between the time or the date at which a security update is released and the time at which is deployed in a typical enterprise, but it typically is probably, well, it's more than 2 months, I think is what we just learned. And I think that's the problem. And so Microsoft is trying to strike a balance between the needs, or at least the wants, of these enterprises and then the needs of the wider ecosystem, because when systems are not protected, that harms everyone. You know, it's like another car analogy. It's sort of like an automotive analogy, the notion of like helmets or seatbelts or whatever. These things are designed to protect individuals, but by wearing these things, you're also protecting other people, because you will be more in control if there's a crash or whatever, and you might not harm other people, and that's the goal. And I think, you know, one of the big problems with this type of issue, this type of event, is that it has a cascading effect across all of the other users. I was talking to Brad, who, you know, I'd hope to have on the show here today, and he's unfortunately busy at the show we're at. But, you know, one of the things we were discussing earlier, I guess it was yesterday, was this kind of notion of, you know, delaying an update is fine, but it needs to be weeks, you know, not months. And you need to be able to do the amount of testing that's required in that period of time, determine that it's safe, and then kind of move on. You know, for consumers, I think there's a broader period of time where you might want to evaluate something major like the Windows 10 Creators Update, and maybe a couple of months might be okay. And that, of course, is a feature update, not a security update, but that will give you the amount of time you need to see in the real world whether there are any problems. And by the way, just on a kind of a side note, there are no major issues with the Creators Update. That's one of the things that we can kind of safely say at this point. So if you're a normal consumer, you might think about actually accepting that update when it comes down. You know, businesses are in that position when it comes to security updates. They have a certain leniency about when they can apply those updates. But I think because they have that ability, they're just pushing this stuff off too far. And I just think that's a huge mistake.
And what about anti-ransomware software? Is that something that you run, or you recommend that people run?
No, this is, you know, it's funny. I with this particular exploit, I tried to research whether there was a way to reverse this, right? And ultimately, I think if you're doing things in kind of a best practices way, which, you know, broad strokes is configuring your computers so that all of your data is backed up to the cloud and in a way that is time stamped, in the sense that you can go back in time, so to speak, to get previous versions of files that aren't infected. And if you treat your PC that way, you should be able to reset your computer, reinstall your apps, resync your data, and be back up and running in a worst case scenario in a matter of hours, frankly, not that many hours either. I mean, it's the process you go through when you configure a new PC. I think the issue for people as individuals is that that's something they don't do that much. And so it seems daunting, and it seems like it's something that's going to take a lot of time. But if you configure these things correctly, it's actually very easy to do. In a business or an education situation, that's something that happens very quickly because they have automated tools for doing this. So if they detect something like this on a network, you should be able to fix that very quickly. But, I mean, the people listening to this show are fine. I think, you know, by and large, they probably get it. I don't think we have any typical, you know, normal, non-technical people, for the most part, listening to the show. Those are the people that are going to be in trouble with this kind of thing. But those are the type of people that will also more typically fall for like a tip, you know, like a phishing type scam or whatever. And this is daunting. You know, semi-related. I mean, I was at getting my hair cut a few months ago or sometime last year, I guess. And a woman ran in crying, and she worked in the place, and she thought the IRS was on the phone with her, and they were demanding that she goes to the bank and withdrew money and gave it to them to pay some tax bill that she didn't actually have. And, you know, on the one hand, you have to be sort of amazed that someone would fall for a scam like that. But of course, people do. And, you know, ransomware is like that. If you are educated about what's going on, if you're prepared for what could happen, you don't want to go through it, but you should be able to get through it just fine. And you shouldn't have to do anything special to make that happen. I think that woman to this day is not completely sure that she was not, in fact, called by the IRS. And I feel bad for her. You know, it took six of us to kind of talk her off the cliff.
Yeah. I mean, and that is the way they get you. Like, they scare you. You know, we know you've been looking at these websites and, you know, we have your, you know, we just anything that you might have done or that, you know, they know some people might have done. And a lot of what we're talking about also is just like that sort of present bias that we all have. Like, you know, I'm going to take care of myself right now. I'm going to, you know, eat this bowl of ice cream instead of the broccoli because I'm just thinking about my present self, not my future self. Like, I'm, you know, I'm not thinking about getting a new system, you know, spending the money to upgrade to Windows 10 right now because, like, this XP is just running just fine when in the end I'm going to end up, you know, having to pay a lot more money if all my systems have, you know, been money, Bitcoin, whatever I have to pay to back up.
You've reminded, I often refer to what I call future Paul and past Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of the eating stuff, you know, of course, the person you would be worried about is future Paul. And I always tell my wife, you know how I feel about future Paul. I mean, screw that guy.
Yes.
You know.
Right. Future Paul's running all of his security updates. But
yes. Yeah. Yeah. He's doing everything right.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, what you said about the kind of it being a privilege, security being a privilege. Privacy is becoming more of a privilege. It's this new digital divide, which is unfortunate. Yep. But I mean, you know, I think that by patching XP, Microsoft is trying to help.
It's one step in the right direction. I mean, they're definitely making other steps in a different direction. But I didn't expect them to do that. So that was actually pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, last week we talked about Build. Build is over. There's a sort of a strategy shift in Microsoft that felt really, really more than ever at Build. We saw that. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I was curious what you thought about this because I know you were kind of listening and we talked to Frank Shar a little bit about this and I'm sure we talked separately about this, but it was kind of fog of war stuff at the time as well. And with the show now over and I've gone back and I've watched a bunch of the session videos, I've watched the keynote again, and you try to look for these little nuances that maybe you kind of missed in the beginning. And the way I presented this strategy shift last week, it's still kind of the way I think about it because I still – When it comes to Microsoft, when it comes to personal computing, whatever, I come at it from a very Windows-centric point of view. So I see this as kind of a Windows story. And so I look at this as a Windows 10 strategy shift. It was interesting to me, but I guess not surprising, that many other people reported on this as more of a mobile strategy on Microsoft's part. And that's equally valid. It's absolutely a mobile strategy. But the way that this works out is that Microsoft has basically formally accepted the fact that, you know, Windows is not at the center of anyone's computing existence anymore like it was, say, in the 1990s or the early 2000s or whatever. We all have many devices. I don't remember the number they used, but they basically said that by 2020, I think it was the average number of devices per, you know, used by an individual is something like 6 to 7. I think most of the people listening to the show can sort of understand how we might get there. We all have multiple devices. I have a laptop here. I have a phone next to me. When I travel, I do bring a mini tablet because I like to use that for movies and so forth. You know, I have a Fitbit. People have smartwatches, whatever they might be. Well, for me, I cover Windows professionally. I've been writing about Windows for 20, 25 years, whatever it is. Only one of these devices runs Windows, you know, and there's an interesting and kind of realistic view of the world. Now, it's one thing for me to say that that's the way the world is, but when Microsoft comes out and talks about it, that's when you kind of have to perk up. And it's a big change, you know, because Windows has evolved over the years. It has now for quite some time not been Microsoft's biggest moneymaker. In fact, even when people sort of thought about Windows as the center of the Microsoft world, actually it was Office that was making the most money at that time. But when you look at it in the context of today and in the future and in devices and where things are going, you know, Windows hopefully will be one of the devices you use. And so the strategy change basically involves adapting Windows to work well within that world and to kind of consciously accept that. They announced some features that work hand in hand with similar features that will be available on phones. You know, the ability to copy and paste on or copy some item, text or a graphic, whatever it might be, on a phone, paste it on a Windows PC or vice versa. The ability to, you know, sync files that work across mobile devices and PCs, which is not new. And some of the other things they talked about. And so to me, like, this is a big deal because I, in a role in the community that we have here on the Windows side, I feel like I need to help people understand what's happening, but also kind of provide my own form of a best practices type thing. And when I look at something like Windows Phone, which is obviously dead and has been for a couple of years, I get a lot of pushback on that. We're talking about a device that has, I don't remember what the latest figure was, like 0.3%, you know, market share, some ridiculous small number. And I still got people who are insisting that Windows Phone is going nowhere. You know, it's fine. Windows is another thing entirely. Windows on PCs. They just announced that there are 500 million active devices running Windows 10. That's a big number. It's kind of a harder case to make that this thing is not a major platform. Now, Google announced today 2 billion plus active Android devices. I think it was in January. I don't know if Apple announced this or however it was revealed. There are basically 1 billion iOS devices. We know that there are 1.5 billion, or we think there still are, Windows devices overall. So about one third of those are running Windows 10 now. These things seem comparable in some ways, right? And it's fair to say they're all big numbers, but you have to look at where things are going as well. And the issues for Windows are that the numbers, well, first of all, the PC market is, you know, shrinking, if you know, or maybe slowing at least. And people are not upgrading very quickly. People are not very engaged. You know, when you talk about something like an iPhone or an Android phone, this is a very personal device. People have their face in it all day long. It's very personal to them. Windows PCs have been relegated to this position of productivity work. Work is not something that people get that excited about. They may see it as more of a slog. They're less likely to browse around an app store. And so aside from just the sheer numbers, which are not in Windows' favor, there's also this notion of kind of user engagement. And I think I know Microsoft sees this. There's a reason Microsoft didn't talk about hard numbers for Windows Store momentum, for example. They talked about exactly three apps that were coming to the store, which is a crazy small number. One of them was iTunes, as you recall. The other two were completely uninteresting. And there's just not a lot of momentum going on there. But that's that's the truth of this world. That's what's happening. And I think it's fascinating because when you think about companies that have lost markets, and you can think of things just in the tech industry like WordPerfect or Lotus 1-2-3 or Netscape or IBM or whatever company you choose to discuss, typically these guys did not move quickly to correct the problem and seek out new markets for themselves. They went too far down that one path that always worked for them and were never able to recover. And so I think you have to give Microsoft some credit for trying here. Windows is not the future of Microsoft. Windows has a future, but it's a fairly limited future, and the scope of it is not as dramatic as, say, it was 20 years ago. And they've accepted that. And to me, that is the most amazing thing of all. You know, it doesn't guarantee success. It doesn't mean that they're going to turn things around, that they're going to sell more PCs every year or anything like that. But they're making the PC better for everyone, and that's true whether or not you accept that this is happening, you know. But I think the important thing is that it's not me saying it now, it's Microsoft saying it. And I think that's the thing I really appreciated. I think I kind of pressed Frank on that last week. I said, so just this is how I perceive it. Am I correct? You know, it was very nice to get someone from Microsoft to actually say, like, yeah, this is what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, what you say about our being attached to this device versus mm-hmm. this device, I think is really true. And it used to be, like you were saying, before this device, if you could get, you know, your team's computer or laptop into the hands of kids at an early age, like you'd have them, right? Like they were all pushing into the schools.
Yeah.
And that was the idea. Turn the tool into a toy and then, you know, you've got the person for life. And now, I mean, it does seem that Microsoft is trying to push into schools. But if what you say is true, where, you know, that laptop, you know, that Windows 10S laptop that they're running will always be a tool and then they'll always reach for their iPhone. Do you think that is what's going to happen?
I think this is inevitable. I mean, you know, Microsoft deserves credit. There's a part of Microsoft that's actually the same part of Microsoft that makes Windows that is making these Surface devices. And they're attractive. I mean, they're really nice devices. They serve a limited role in the world. And they serve an important role. I mean, and for me personally, it's something I use all day long, every day. But I'm trying to see beyond my own, you know, particular needs. I happen to be a writer, so I need a keyboard. Is the future of this stuff, you know, the phone that you dock or, you know, wirelessly dock and all of a sudden the screen lights up and you get a keyboard and a mouse or whatever? You know, honestly, yeah, probably. You could make an argument that thing is technically a PC as well. Fine, you know, we can argue semantics or whatever. But, yeah, these things are tools. I mean, I think that's why we see Chromebooks as being so successful in schools where that kind of thing matters, where it's about cost and manageability. For individuals who have more money, they have beautiful Surface devices and other PCs and Macs, you know, that to choose from, which will be the is a market of a certain size. But for most of the planet, the phone is the computer, you know. And even in developed countries like the United States, for many people, the phone is the computer too. And they only sometimes have to go to a device with a bigger screen to maybe type for a long period of time for whatever reason. It's something they don't usually do. Maybe they want to print something or perform some unusual task. But we've become very comfortable with these devices. And not only is there an entire generation of people growing up using them primarily, there's an entire planet worth of people who are probably going to use them fairly exclusively.
And what about Xbox? I mean, that's a toy, always a toy. And they've tried to cross over, you know, having being able to play Xbox games on your Windows 10 machine. I mean, is that something that you see them pushing harder to say, like, hey, like, we make Xbox too?
Well, it's funny because they don't really talk about that too much. You know, obviously this year they're going to announce a new version of the Xbox One, this Project Scorpio. And it's very, for people who are into gaming, it's very exciting. For people into Xbox in particular, like myself, it's very exciting. But you kind of have to look at the numbers. Video game players tend to be very engaged, and so you don't have that problem like we have on a Windows 10 PCs. But they're not going to be particularly engaged to run, you know, Twitter or a Microsoft Word or off, you know, any of that stuff on a gaming console or on a screen. And so it's kind of a different type of engagement. But if you look just at the numbers, for example, I mentioned 500 million active Windows 10 PCs in the world. There are approximately 33 million Xbox Ones versus 60 million PlayStation 4s, which is the market leader in that particular market. 33 million is not a small number, but compared to 500 million, compared to 1 billion iOS, compared to 2 billion Android, it's a very small number. And it's not going to help. You know, that the ability to run games across Windows 10 and Xbox One is absolutely a huge advantage for a certain group of people that want to play those games. Like, and I'm in this group, I mean, to be very clear. I think it's great. But we're talking about a relatively small audience. So what Microsoft talks about when they talk about Xbox these days are not console sale figures because they don't look that good, but they talk about, well, engagement, frankly. They talk about Xbox Live usage, how it's going up, how there are more people paying for Xbox Live Gold subscriptions. And, of course, those numbers can look good because they're bringing this stuff to Windows 10. And so in the context of that world, that 500 million strong audience of Windows 10 users, not all of whom will play games, obviously. In fact, probably only a small percentage. But that is an opportunity to grow the Xbox ecosystem in a way that they would not be able to do just with a console by itself.
And what about Minecraft? Like, that's the ultimate tool toy. I mean, what role does Minecraft play in the future of Microsoft?
You know, it's funny. When Microsoft bought Mojang to get Minecraft, I don't remember the number. Maybe you know the number off the top of your head, but it was some billions of dollars. And I thought, this is the craziest waste of money. It made no sense to me. But, you know, I'm in the sense that I'm wrong about just about everything, I guess. honestly, this has been one of their most strategic purchases. And Minecraft is the most special solution. I don't even want to call it a game. It's a game. You know, And very early on, before Microsoft bought this company, when my kids were still young, my son Mark was in his room. And I heard strange music. And so I walked in and he was flying around some virtual world. It looked terrible. It looks like 8-bit graphics. And I said, what are you doing? And he says, I'm playing Minecraft. And he says, what are you doing in Minecraft? He says, well, you build these buildings and worlds and things. And I said, okay. And I said, and then when you build the world, do you have a multiplayer deathmatch in that world? Is that the point of it? Like it's a map creator kind of thing, like you would see in a shooter. And he said, no. And then as we were talking, this other person flew by him on the screen. And I said, who's that? And he says, that's my cousin Harrison. And they were online together as little kids in this virtual world, building things, just building to build. There's no killing. There's no awfulness. It's just you. Well, there is actually. I mean, you could be killed by zombies and things. But I mean, you're not in there to fight people. You're in there to create. And just even in that basic sense, I thought this thing was a little bit special. I thought that was kind of cool. But if you flash forward to today, it's become an educational tool, right? There's an education version of Minecraft. Hosted in labs and schools where teachers can oversee things and assign students tasks and have them do things and they can learn. But then they can also learn very specifically using software development technologies. And so now there are programmable aspects to Minecraft where you can write code that will build and enhance worlds and make things happen in those worlds. And that's incredible. And it's entirely within keeping in keeping with what Microsoft is as a company. It's a company focused. Productivity is kind of a broad term. They're using the creator's term to kind of describe that same thing these days. But the sense of creation, right, which is creative in some ways, but is also just, you know, being productive. But as an e-learning tool, as a way to teach software development skills at a very early age, it's amazing. I mean, so, you know, whatever the raw numbers are in Minecraft, they just surpassed some huge milestone. I wish I apologize for not knowing that number either off the top of my head. But it was some kind of I think it was units sold or number of users playing it or whatever it is. Minecraft is humongous, right? And in some ways, you could almost make the case that Minecraft is a much more important business to Microsoft than the console business is.
I think it is. I mean, especially when you think about, you know, the next generation. I have 12-year-olds and, you know, they'll have 15 kids over to the house. They'll all play together. You know, they all have it. They all do it. I don't think there's anything else. But
they,
you know,
play Minecraft.
Yeah,
that's amazing. No, that's great, right? I mean, you know, when my son was young, for the most part, he played shooter games, which are violent. And you have to have that little kind of moral tick in the back of your head. It's like, is this okay?
Mm-hmm.
And there's all kinds of things kids can do, obviously. But as far as electronics go, you know, Minecraft is one of those things you can feel really good about. I mean, I can't think of any major concern that anyone would have with this.
You can blow up cows. You can, you know, there's the creative mode and then there's the other mode. And so that's part of it too, because
the
kids,
the cow destroying mode.
You know, if you just look over their shoulder, you're like, oh, that's amazing. You're learning to code. You're going to be rich someday.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, Matthew Broderick's mom in War Games. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there is, they can sneak in there and do things, you know, not too much harm. But, you know, it is like, it's not, I wouldn't call it a violent game, but, you know, it's not all creative mode, so there's some ways that kids can push the limits.
It's still fun, you mean?
Yeah, it's still fun. Exactly, blowing up, you know, digital cows is fun. So, yeah, I mean, it will be interesting to see. I think that in a lot of ways, you know, we just got done watching Google I/O, and I was watching, and I was like, this is a little boring. But I think, and I've thought this for a while, that Microsoft, you know, they went through their boring phase, and now what they're doing is interesting.
Yeah, when you get to 2 billion users, you pretty much can't be that exciting, because at this point you're, you know, just dragging in the stragglers. I mean, there's not, you know, where are you going to go from here?
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of what Microsoft's strategy is the cloud too, which, I mean, isn't that exciting? Yep. It's not, you know, but it is, it's a big part of what they do as well.
Yeah. And I think that part of Microsoft is the future of Microsoft. And I don't know if you saw the graphic that was out the other day. They basically showed, using those kind of circular graphs, that I think it was Amazon, Facebook, Apple, and Google were pretty much one hit wonders, right? That the vast majority of their revenues comes from a single product, like the iPhone, you know, on Apple, which I think is somewhere 65-70% of their revenues. Ad revenues at Google's are over 90% of their revenues. And then there was Microsoft. And Microsoft is actually pretty well diversified between major product lines, cloud and Azure, Office 365, Windows. And so server was a big chunk, but actually still on-prem server. And that's great. And part of that, I think, is actually that they're midway through some transition, and that transition involves that pie growing a little differently and more toward the cloud stuff, and that the client stuff and the on-prem stuff, in the case of server, is what is going to go away over time. And I know that freaks people out. It kind of freaks me out a little bit as well, but you know, I focus very much on the client side stuff. And so I watch this with some sense of apprehension as well, because I have no interest in covering the, you know, 17,000 services that Azure provides these days. I just don't care about that stuff. But there is an amazing future for Microsoft there. There's an amazing present for Microsoft there. It's a big company, just looking at that stuff. But I think that's where they're headed.
Well, we talked a little bit about Windows 10 Fall Creators Update last week, but we had to speed through it. You had a lot of guests. So I want to talk more about that. But first, if you're watching the show, chances are you're a geek. You have turned all your devices into toys. They've been toys your whole life. And you like to throw technology at problems, or throw problems at technology. And you can do that with Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. You can get a mortgage very easily in your home. You don't have to even get dressed. You can wear your pajamas and sit on the couch. What better way to get a mortgage than that? Windows Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. And when it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone who you can trust and someone who has your best interest in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you'll get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. You don't have to waste your time searching through stacks of paperwork. With Rocket Mortgage, you can securely share your financial information to get a mortgage approval in minutes. You can adjust the rate and the length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the mortgage solution that's right for you. So you have those sliders. You can slide it back and forward and see, you know, how much you can afford, what you need to save in order to afford that house that you really want or to refinance your house. You're just sitting on the couch in your pajamas, sliding those sliders, figuring out your future. What could be better than that? So whether you're looking to buy a home or refinance your existing mortgage, you can lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/windows. That's quickenloans.com/windows. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of Windows Weekly. All right, so Windows 10 Fall Creators Update. What are the biggest takeaways about that, Paul?
You know, it's funny. I go up and down on things. You know, in the keynote address, for example, as they announce new features, I have a knee-jerk reaction like anyone else does. And then I go back, and in this case, I rewatch the keynote, but I also watch some of those session videos, like I was saying. And you can kind of apply this kind of experience-based, you know, changing of mind kind of thing to almost all of this stuff. It's really interesting to go back and look at, well, it's interesting to me. It's probably not interesting to anyone else, but I go back and look at what I wrote, you know, at the time, and then I look, you know, and things change, you know. So, for example, one of the things that Microsoft kept secret from the press ahead of Build was this new creative app, which we now know is called Story Remix. And we now know that it's actually not a new creative app at all. It's just part of the Photos app, which is something they never really said during Build, and I don't understand that. That demo was really cool, right? This is the one where they added like the fire effect to the soccer ball, and the girl kicked it into the net, and it was, you know, it was just kind of awesome. It was like a Tyrannosaurus Rex chasing a girl in kind of a mixed reality looking scene that the kids in school were able somehow to make on their own. In a build of Windows 10 that was released last week, pre-release build, this capability became available. It's not in its own app. It's in the Photos app. And okay, fine. So it's a kind of a feature. And then you look at it, and of course, it's not anything like the thing that they demoed on screen. It's basically just a way to take photos and video clips and turn them into kind of a slideshow that has an automatic movie accompaniment. If you want that, you can add titles and so forth. It's not a video editor, right? It's not like iMovie or Windows Movie Maker. It's a way to kind of automate the process of creating kind of a cool little, you know, memory from some event. The two things to that are, A, on the pro side, I think this is the kind of thing most people need. I don't think anyone's ever going to sit down and edit videos. You know, we all thought we were going to do that. I don't know what you were like when you first had your children, but you videotaped the first one a lot. You've got all this raw video. You think you're going to make a video out of it. And I don't know. I never did it, but, you know, I recorded a lot of video that I never did anything with. The second child comes along and I can't even remember her middle name because it's not the same situation. That's the way kids are. It's weird. I actually do remember her middle name. So that's neat. I think they've created something that normal people can use, and that's cool. On the flip side, this is really not that exciting. I mean, especially not as delivered. Now, granted, if they add that mixed reality stuff, it will get interesting, but this thing looks a lot like, because it's based on this product Microsoft already makes called Sway. It reminds me of stuff that Microsoft used to do 10, maybe even 15-ish years ago when they had something called Photo Story, which should sound a little bit familiar because it has the word story in it. And it's about photos. And it was the same kind of thing. You dump photos into it. It mixes them up. And I think the remix part of this is there's a button that you can just – it will just remix which photos. And it fits the photos to fit the length of the song. And so if you have 17 photos, maybe only 14 of them can make it. And so each time you remix it, you might get a slightly different mix of photos. And you're going to lose some as well, which I think is kind of a downer. Anyway, it's like a lot of tech demos. You know, it looks awesome on stage. And then you use it in real life and you realize this thing actually still has kind of a long way to go. And so that that's like, you know, like it looked so awesome on stage and then it didn't really kind of hold up. On the kind of opposite end of the spectrum, they talked about something called the Microsoft Fluent Design System, which is a replacement for that Metro design language that Microsoft debuted in Windows Phone, you know, back in, I think it was 2010. And my initial knee-jerk reaction to this was kind of negative because what they're doing here is creating a design language that is influenced by non-2D interfaces like HoloLens or mixed reality and augmented reality. And that just doesn't seem to me off the top of my head like something that would be a good idea for flat 2D interfaces like we use today on phones or computer screens or whatever. But in sitting through some pretty lengthy sessions about this and listening to people talk about it and showing the actual examples of how this would work, actually, I'm kind of coming around to this. And it's interesting because it's not necessarily a major change over with the Metro style, you know, the flat user interface. That Google also does, by the way, with the Material Design and Android, and Apple also does in iOS 7 or newer on the iPhone or the iPad. But it has some nice kind of visual cues to it. It's kind of a neat thing. They're phasing it over time, which is a little goofy, but it also allows this design language to have the same feedback-driven loop that we see in Windows 10. And so that actually makes some sense. So people will provide feedback and they'll say, maybe we need this, maybe you should take this out, whatever it is. And so this thing will change over time. So they've delivered, seven or eight different elements of this design that they think will be available in the next version of Windows 10. They have very specific examples of where they intend to put it and what it will look like. And then they provided some vaguer examples of how that stuff will progress going forward. But actually, I think this is pretty cool. I think this is something that will nicely modernize the look of Windows and Microsoft apps across devices, frankly. I don't think this is going to be relegated just to Windows, but you'll see this obviously on Xbox and on HoloLens, but you'll probably see it on Microsoft apps on iOS and Android as well. And so that's kind of cool.
And so we'll all be ready when we walk around with our HoloLenses strapped to our head.
Well, I don't think, hopefully no one will ever do that, but but if you are having an AR experience or in a mixed reality or a VR experience, whatever, you know, we try to adapt the ways that we interact with things to new things, you know. And so one of the goofy things that happens when you move to these headsets is what you want it to do is just kind of respond to your motions and everything. But what you eventually realize is we need a mouse, you know. And so all of these systems have something you hold in your hand that helps you move stuff around in space. And it's kind of weird. Like these things have to kind of move forward. But on the flip side, there are these visual cues that they develop for these interfaces that actually, as it turns out, makes some sense on traditional 2D screens as well. So I kind of dismissed that. When they were describing that initially, I thought, you know, the notion of there being anything valuable from HoloLens that would come to, you know, Windows 10 didn't make any sense to me. But when you look at what they did, actually, it's pretty cool.
And
Yeah, go ahead.
If I could go back to Story Remix real quick. I think the hard part of that about that, I mean, they did say it will come to iOS, it'll come to Android. But, I mean, the way Google is already doing this, I don't see how it could be any better. Like, I feel like Google, if you put your photos in Google Photos, you know, you press two buttons and suddenly you've made this beautiful slideshow for your mom for Mother's Day, you know, with no work at all. And so,
well, by the way, even better than that, really, because, you know, if you think about what StoryMix really is, it's a tool that you go to explicitly to do something. I think one of the wonderful things about Google Photos is that it alerts you when it's done something. You know, it will say, hey, you had this cool event yesterday. Here's a little movie we made. And it's doing what StoryRemix did for you automatically without you prompting it. Both approaches are valid. But I think there's in the same way that most people aren't going to sit down with a linear video editor and make a home movie, most people probably aren't going to use this tool to make a home movie either. However, most people presented with one that some AI robot in the sky made for them, if it was awesome, would probably say, nice, thanks, save, you know, and then you could share it from there. I mean, this is an area that I think Google's done a great job. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So is it what else with Windows 10 Fall Creator Update?
Well, you know, the cross-device experiences, I think, is a big one. This is the thing where, you know, Windows 10 is just a piece of the pie. This stuff is fascinating to me. There's some stuff you could look at that's in there that will be very familiar to any Mac or iOS user because Apple does a bunch of this stuff, like handoff and so forth. But, you know, as is always the case with what Apple does, that stuff is really easy when you control the whole chain. You know that everyone using these things is using your device. So you have a certain number of Macs, you have a certain number of iOS devices. Making those things work together, I'm not saying it's easy, but it's easier than making it work with anything. And so when Microsoft does something like Timeline or Pickup where you left off and they let that stuff work, in other words, like a handoff type thing that works across platforms, platforms they do not control, that gets really interesting. But it also introduces kind of a technical challenge. And the technical challenge, especially on iOS, is how do you get your stuff on a system that by nature is closed? And so Microsoft's done some, I don't want to call it innovative, but some tricky or interesting things. You know, for example, if you want to do that cross-platform copy and paste, you have to use their SwiftKey keyboard on those devices. That's the in that they have for that kind of thing. It's a really good idea. It's going to limit its appeal, though, in some ways, right? Because I don't think a lot of iOS users are necessarily even going to discover that this is a thing, let alone discovering it's a thing, then deciding to actually do it, which, frankly, I think is the biggest issue with this strategy. Not that it's not a good idea. It's an excellent idea. It's just the general ambivalence that people might have about making it happen. You know, convincing people of the value of this stuff, I think, is going to be a little bit difficult. But, I think it's really cool that they're doing this. I mean, like I said, there aren't many companies that would have done this to their core products, to adapt them to the changing world like they have here. And we'll see how it goes. But it looks very, very interesting. Each one of these things relies on some Microsoft solution being on the device, right? So you're going to need Cortana. You're going to need the SwiftKey keyboard. Like I said, you're going to need OneDrive. These are the realities of what's happening there.
Yeah, I mean, you see that's really the difference between, you know, a keynote speech versus the reality of, you know, of what it, you know, when you have to have that piece. Like today, Google I.O., you know, hooray, you have Google Assistant. You can get it on your iPhone. But I'm not going to be able to press this button and get it on my iPhone. Like, I'm going to have to go into the app. And, you know, so it's just the reality of, okay. And it makes sense. I mean, they're concerned with their bottom line and they want an in. You know, there's a reason that Amazon wants to finally get on the Apple TV and, you know, that they'll finally sell Apple TVs. Like, everybody has their in to, you know, the other, to try to convince you to switch over to their team, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many pros and cons in any kind of platform strategy. You know, Apple has a very vertical situation where they can really rely on the fact that everyone's going to update to the latest version. They make it very easy. Mac users, by and large, are probably going to use iPhones, you know, and so you get a virtuous cycle there. You can release the feature like handoff where things happen between iOS devices and your Mac. They don't do it with a PC, right? That would be really hard. It's not impossible, by the way, but maybe they just don't see the value because the volume side of this is on the devices side. But in the Microsoft world, we actually see that in the cloud. You know, when Microsoft moves Office to the cloud with Office 365, they get into a completely different situation where they don't have to worry about whether a business has Exchange and SharePoint, right? In the old days, they would improve these products individually because that's all they could rely on. You know, you'll upgrade to a new version of Exchange or you'll get some feature pack for Exchange. When you have Office 365, you know that all your customers have everything. And so you can stop thinking about these things as individual products and you can think of them as kind of a heterogeneous whole. You can add features to SharePoint that would not work if you didn't have Exchange. You know, it's kind of a neat thing. But it only benefits the people who are there, you know, like, you know, that's kind of the trick. I mean, the other stuff from the keynote, I mean, I guess the big one would probably be mixed reality. And my tune has not changed there. I mean, I'm mixed, mixed reality.
You haven't augmented your tune on...
No, I, you know, this is a goofy one because Terry Morrison came out and he described mixed reality as the next wave of computing. It's a wave. It's a wave with a small W. It's not the next wave. It's not. In fact, the next wave is already here. It's ambient computing. It's this thing with Google Assistant and all the personal assistants and those appliances we see in homes, which are the beginning of that, you know, that. There being sensors everywhere that are always listening so that we can just speak and have things happen no matter where we are. This future is so obvious, I have a hard time understanding people arguing the point, but clearly this is what's happening. The most interesting thing about it is that Amazon is leading this market, because if you had asked anyone 2.5 years ago, who do you think will do best in this market? I think most people would have said, well, Google, obviously, and Microsoft could probably do some of this stuff because they have a search engine and they have Cortana, and Apple has Siri. They'll probably do pretty well. Microsoft and Apple are incredibly late to market. Even Google was late to market. That product was not very good at first. It looks like it's gotten a lot better. They just announced a bunch of new stuff today, too. So I'm sure that's off to the races. But yet Amazon, it's Amazon that's winning this one, and that's crazy town. Mm-hmm. This is a much bigger market, I think, especially in the short term, than anything related to mixed reality or augmented reality or whatever we're calling it these days. But for Microsoft specifically, I think the big issue is that they've always had a hard time being honest about what they're delivering when it comes to what they now call mixed reality. So when they were calling it augmented reality and they had HoloLens and that was the only way to do this, they still show off these stage demonstrations where it looks like you're seeing stuff all mixed together, like you've got little virtual objects in a real world and all that. And that's not what it looks like when you wear that headset. It's not that it's not impressive, but it's that you've got this little kind of viewport thing. You can see the real world everywhere, but you only see holograms in a little strip in the middle, like a movie screen thing. And I think that severely diminishes the experience. But on the mixed reality side, I guess we should really call it VR, these mixed reality headsets that Microsoft is now promoting and that will ship much later in the year, they're just VR, right? I mean, that's literally all this is. There is no augmented anything. There are no holograms in there. There's no mixing of anything. You're occluded. You don't see the outside world. It's virtual reality. Virtual reality has been around for a long time. Google is pushing what I would call their third generation VR platform this week. They started with Cardboard. They have Daydream, and now they have these standalone headsets, and it's getting better, but it's still virtual reality. I think you were alluding earlier to Project Tango, mm-hmm. which is their augmented reality solution. And let's be serious. You're still confined to a viewport issue because your phone is the viewport, but you're out in the world with this thing like you are because it's your phone. It's that most personal of devices. And you may have seen some of the demos they have for those where you go to a museum and maybe you're looking at a dinosaur skeleton that's there in the real world. When you hold up the phone, you can see what the dinosaur would have looked like 60 million years ago, whatever the time frame is. That's really impressive. And I think it's not that it's more impressive than what Microsoft has done with HoloLens. But it does run on a sub-$1,000 computer that more people can afford, or phone. And it's something you can carry in your pocket and you bring around with you. And it's more applicable, I think, to real-world scenarios. Like, it's a more realistic kind of look at what that world could be. And so if this thing's going to be a wave of some sort, personal computing wave, it's going to be that kind of thing. Not the thing where I'm tethered with a wire to a computer with a mixed reality headset, which I've already established is a very non-engaged audience to begin with. So I don't quite understand what the excitement is around this. I just don't think it's ever going to be a big thing, especially on Windows PCs.
Yeah. And I mean, it has been a while. Like you said that they're late to market in terms of the home devices, like the Amazon Echo. Mm-hmm. And someone in the chat room said Microsoft is always late to market. But I mean, yeah. they were the first to really talk about augmented reality yep. in a big stage. That was, I think, January 2015, when they first mm-hmm. Showed off the HoloLens and, you know, holograms. And it was exciting, the idea of, you know, playing Minecraft in your living room.
Yep.
But, and I don't think even then they weren't saying, like, you're going to get it, you know, in a couple months. I think it's far off. But, yeah, who knows? I do think that you're right, that the next wave of computing is here, and it is home assistants. And so what do you think about Microsoft's, you know, they have the Harman Kardon deal with that speaker. But they really, I mean, have you ever heard any rumors that they were going to create their own sort of in-home speaker that is powered by Cortana?
No. So far, the indication has been that they're going to go the PC route, which is to use their partner ecosystem. You know, I know HP announced something. Intel is doing reference designs that will allow anyone to make these things. You know, whether it makes sense for Microsoft to do a, you know, maybe a Surface-branded Cortana appliance or whatever, you know, maybe. But we were kind of arguing for that last fall. And I just feel like this stuff is just too far behind. There's room in this market for different solutions, don't get me wrong, but I don't think one of those is going to be Microsoft. And it's not because they don't deserve to be there. It's not because their technology isn't impressive. You know, Cortana is actually pretty great, but you can identify these key problems. Lateness to market is obviously one of them. Its reliance on Windows is a huge one because Cortana is available on iOS and Android. But who would use such a thing? And like you said, you can't typically press that button to have it come up. Although actually, you can do that on Android if you configure it where that interface is. But you'll never be able to do that on an iPhone. This is the same problem. This is the Windows Phone problem. You know. It's innovative. There's some great ideas there. In fact, their ideas are so great, everyone else is copying them. But this thing is not going to take off for the same exact reason. It's too late, too slow, too limited. You know, Microsoft's kind of push with consumers is not very broad. They just don't have this installed base that cares. That Cortana is available in Windows 10 is not particularly interesting to a lot of people, I think. You know, they put it on Xbox. You know, they put it on Windows. It's on Windows phones. Who cares? It's on iOS and Android. That doesn't matter. I don't know. I don't sense any alacrity here from Microsoft. I kind of feel like there should have been some, but I just feel like it's kind of too late for that stuff.
What do you use Cortana for?
Just for reminders, basically. I mean, the truth is, you know, we bought, used, and then returned an Alexa device. I think this is the original Echo. We bought and then never took out of the box the Google Home when it first came out because it didn't support multiple accounts, which it does now. And then now, of course, it has many, many more features as well. My wife uses an Android phone. My kids use iPhones and I use an iPhone typically. I do not use Siri. I actually disable Siri, although you probably know because I think you use an iPhone. If you press and hold in the stupid things. No, it just says... It says, please turn me on.
Please.
You know. But I think that's because I'm on the lock screen. I think if I actually do this, it still does the same thing. So, yeah, anyway, I disable it. I just don't have a lot of – I don't personally have a lot of use for it. I see the use for it. My wife is someone who will talk to her. You know, she'll say, remind me to – you know, she'll do that kind of stuff. And I do that. I do that. Although, you know, as a PC user, I tend to do it with typing, not by speaking. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could configure it to work with your voice. But the problem is when I don't want to say the keyword here because I know people listening maybe have Cortana or whatever enabled. I don't want to trigger devices everywhere. But in my office, because I test so many different devices, if I say, you know, one of those key phrases, like, you know, 8 different devices could pop, you know, to life hoping to help me with something. So, yeah, I'm trying, you know, because, you know, like, I really do feel like this is huge. Like, there's no doubt about it. This is a big future interface for computing and a present interface as well. But I'm just sort of not part of it right now. And I think it's because I'm primarily a PC guy.
Mm. Well, I think that was one of the things they announced at I.O. today, that you can communicate with Google Assistant by typing in your phone to your Google Home. So it might be time to get it out of the box.
That makes sense. That's good cross-device stuff. You know, it's like if you have an Apple TV, you can type passwords in on your iPhone, mm-hmm. you know, or right. search or whatever. It's nice.
Well, we're going to talk about OneDrive. We're going to talk about some developer news. You have some picks, even an iOS app. But first, I want to thank Blue Apron. Blue Apron is a great service. You've probably heard of it. If you watch any of our shows, you've heard us talk about it. It's a great service. I use it. I get meals delivered in a box. Ice comes in there, keeps all the food fresh, and then the instructions come on a laminated piece of paper, so I don't have to do anything except make the food, and sometimes I don't even make the food. Sometimes my husband makes the food, which is great to just come home and eat it. And the best part is I can get to choose. I get to look through the Blue Apron. I control the account, and I can say, yes, that's what we're going to eat, and that's what we're going to eat, and I don't have to go shopping because... cooking is only half of the battle. Shopping is a bigger part of the battle. And then you buy these giant bottles of who knows what and you use it once and it just goes to waste. But Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with the quality ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. And it's good food. It's fresh. It's the highest. They set the highest quality standards for their community of over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. So you know your food is coming from a good place. They ship the exact amount of each ingredient required for a recipe, so all that extra stuff doesn't go to waste. Blue Apron is reducing food waste. And when you order Blue Apron, you are reducing food waste at home and just in general. Their freshness guarantee promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, or they will make it right. It's great. If you don't get to cook the food that night or the next night, it's okay. It's still going to be fresh. It comes fresh and it stays fresh. Blue Apron delivers to 99% of the continental U.S. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. You want to skip a week? Skip a week. You get to do that. You get to decide. Customize your recipes every week based on your dietary preferences. You can choose from a variety of new recipes each week, or let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. I hope you're not hungry when you're listening to this, because I'm about to read some really delicious recipes. If you're not hungry, you will be. Baked spinach and egg flatbread with sautéed asparagus and lemon aioli. Beef teriyaki stir fry with sugar snap peas and lime rice. Crispy salmon and roasted potato salad with pickled mustard seeds and creme fraiche sauce. Three cheese and baby broccoli stromboli with tomato and oregano dipping sauce. So check out this week's menu, and you can get three meals free with your first purchase, and you get free shipping by going to blueapron.com/windows. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. Don't wait. Go to blueapron.com/windows. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. All right, OneDrive files on demand. That was some news from this week.
Before we do that, I just want to quickly mention two things that I actually think were kind of big last week that were not mentioned in the keynote. Windows 10 on ARM was never discussed. Progressive web apps, I don't think they ever actually uttered this phrase in one of the keynotes. I could be wrong. It might have been one time, but neither of these things were highlighted in any meaningful way. And I did get a bunch of questions about that stuff. Microsoft put up a video about Windows 10 on ARM related to Build. You can find it on Channel 9. And actually, the key takeaway there was, I think the reason they didn't discuss it is because there's nothing to say. It literally is just Windows 10 running on ARM. Like, there's nothing to know. It's just going to work. You know, so there's nothing really to show. It's like, look, it looks just like Windows 10 because it literally is Windows 10. And so I think that does explain that. The progressive web app thing was kind of interesting. This is my opinion, but I feel like Microsoft had this kind of big revelation about Windows and its new role in this emerging ecosystem of heterogeneous devices and so forth. And I feel like they were not predisposed to come out with some more of what some people would perceive as bad news and kind of say, look, you know, this notion of universal Windows platform apps, this is not really taking off. No one's really doing this. And you know, maybe we should go in a different direction. So they never really said anything like that, although I think their sheer lack of information about any numbers related to UWP was very interesting. And like I mentioned, they only announced three new store apps, which is crazy. One of them, though, was iTunes. And one of the other two was a similar app in the sense that it was a desktop app that they were porting to the Windows Store using that desktop bridge technology. And I think those kind of hybrid store apps are actually the future of apps on Windows. And those apps will run on Windows 10S, for example. They don't, you know, require the desktop stuff to be fully enabled. And I think that's really important. And so progressive web apps, there are actually at least three sessions at the show. I watched those three at least. They're worth watching because if Windows users aren't familiar with these things, they're progressive in the sense that they'll work and provide additional features across different types of platforms. So they'll run on the web. They might offer more features on a mobile device, and they might offer more features still in a full-featured desktop operating system like macOS or Windows. They're locally installable. They'll be distributed to the store on Windows 10, so they will be store apps. They're obviously updated in the cloud, which is awesome because you don't have to worry about that kind of stuff. They're safe, secure, one-click install, all that kind of stuff. I really feel like progressive web apps are the future of most apps on Windows. Microsoft has even made a web app game, which you can, I don't know the URL, so that was a great story, Paul, but they've made a flight simulator type game that is a web app. It uses WebGL. It supports accelerometers, so you can steer the plane by tilting a device. It supports a gamepad, like an Xbox game controller, if you have such a thing. So This is a really rich platform. So that's, you know, maybe that's something for the future. But I was curious that they didn't mention either one of those things at all in the keynotes.
I had a question about iTunes. Does that mean that you can get Apple Music on a Windows 10 device? Like you can subscribe to Apple Music, or could you already do that?
Yeah. So, I mean, iTunes is available on Windows today as like, you know, a desktop application, mm-hmm. right? So it's a big monolithic, you know, piece of junk. Terrible. It's a terrible application. You know, if you use Apple Music on a device, you know that it's, you know, whatever you think of it, it's a modern app. It's you know, it's not Apple has, I don't remember when they did this. It became Music at one point. They got rid of, you know, the iTunes app or whatever they called it. The iPod app, I think it was called actually, on iOS a long time ago. But they never really did this on the Mac or Windows. And so if you're on Mac or Windows and you want to use Apple Music, you have to go through iTunes. And it's still this Byzantine kind of old fashioned looking app. And so the store version of the app, everyone is presuming, because no one has said otherwise, is going to be that app wrapped in a container and distributed through the store. So it will be exactly the same thing as we have today that you download from, you know, itunes.apple.com or whatever the URL is. I don't think it's going to be any different. I think it's just going to be the same app.
So is there anything else we missed about Windows 10 Creators Update?
No, I think that's most of it.
So, ready to talk about OneDrive?
Yes. Yes, I can do that. So, I talked to the Office 365 folks ahead of the announcement about this feature, which is the long overdue and long awaited return of a feature called Placeholders. Placeholders was in one version of Windows only. It was in Windows 8.1. So, if you have any other version of Windows, or if you have a Mac, because it works exactly the same way, you can do like a full sync of your OneDrive storage to the device, or you can do selective sync, where you literally go down and check off the boxes for each of the folders you want to sync, and that's what you get. And so when you're offline, you can't see any of the stuff that's not synced to the device. And so it's, you know, it works the way it works. The way that placeholders worked was that they put a placeholder file to represent every single file and folder that was in OneDrive. So when you were offline, you could actually see your entire OneDrive storage on the device. People love this feature. The downside to it, or actually there are many downsides to it, but one of the two big ones are you could get into a situation where you're on a plane and you double click on a file to open it and it doesn't open because it's not really there. It's just a placeholder file. And because you're offline, perhaps in this time of day, there was no way to access it. There's some frustration there. You might have thought you were going to get some work done on the flight, but now you can't because the file's not available. The other issue is that placeholder files take up space. And so even though, you know, let's say you had 50 gigabytes of data up in OneDrive and it was, you know, 17,000 files or whatever it works out to, every one of those files took up some, you know, 2K, 3K, for whatever it was, because it's sort of a thumbnail or a representation of the underlying file. Windows 10 can be installed on, or any version of Windows really, but can be installed on a device with as little as 16 or 32 gigabytes of storage. And on such a system, if you did a full sync, I'm sorry, you don't have to do any sync. Sorry, you just have placeholders. Just the sheer number of the placeholders required by your OneDrive storage would fill up all of the storage in your device. So not only can you not access those files because they're just placeholders, but you actually run out of storage because the placeholders take up so much space. So they tried to figure out a workaround for this, couldn't do it. And so in Windows 10, they got rid of placeholders. And so since Windows 10 has come out, we've just had selective sync and then, or full sync. OneDrive Files on Demand is a new feature that will debut in the Windows 10 Fall Creators Update in September. It is a replacement for placeholders. It is essentially placeholders. There's kind of a subtle distinction about how they show you these. They're not calling them placeholders, but the files are represented in the file system as sort of like placeholders. They don't take up any space individually, meaning that each thing you see in the file system does not have some space associated with it. If you right-click on it, we'll say you're 0K or 0 bytes or whatever it says. If you're offline, you actually won't see them. Excuse me, I'm sorry. I'm getting this backwards. If you are offline, you will see them, but they still take up zero space. So how does that work? You know, magic, software magic, I don't know. I asked them to clarify this because in my mind, I don't understand how this could be any different than placeholders. And the difference is they have a central cache that holds the thumbnails for all of those files. It's significantly smaller than placeholders, and it's related to two things. One of them is just an optimization they've done on the size of the thumbnails. They're much smaller individually, but also there's some optimization related to the fact that it's a single big file instead of a bunch of small files, and that actually saves some space because of disk sectors and technology. I don't understand. It doesn't really matter. It might as well be magic. But anyway, it takes up a lot less space. And so this actually does answer the need. And this is something I misunderstood, because when I had the meeting with one with the Office 365 folks about this feature, I asked about this very thing. And I said, so if you're offline, you can't see anything. And they said, yep. And that's what I wrote, but that was incorrect. Actually, if you're offline, you can see them and you still can't access them. It works actually like placeholders does. So if you're missing this feature, it's coming back.
Well, it's one of those things. It's like you don't really care how it works. Like you said, it's just magic, like unless you're a developer.
Yep. Yeah, it was like big words. Yeah, I don't know. Okay, whatever.
Right. I just want my files when I want them. Yeah, it's the same. I mean, it's the same with iOS too. It's like, you know, iCloud is very confusing. It's like, are these really my files, or is this just a, you know, a thumbnail of my files? But I don't really care how it works as long as I have them whenever I want them.
Yeah, iCloud is a little bit like Story Remix or whatever, the Google Photos thing. Like, you just sort of, it's like, thank you for doing it. I don't, not really paying attention here, but I'm glad it's there.
Right, exactly.
OneDrive is interesting because I relied very heavily on placeholders. I really enjoyed this feature. And because they made this change, a lot of people really lost faith with Microsoft over this one. It was a big deal a couple of years ago. I actually changed the way that I sync things to the cloud because of this. And so the way I've been working now for probably close to 2 years, I think, maybe longer than 2 years, let's say 2 years-ish, is I have a very specific way of syncing. I do selective sync, and so I can select the things that I want to sync. And it's a very small chunk of stuff now, because I've kind of modularized or segmented the stuff out or whatever it is on a kind of a month-by-month basis. So like this computer that I have here, because I've been using it for a while, I can go and look. It has March, April, and May stuff in it. But if I were to bring a new computer online this month, it would just have May, and then it would eventually have June. You know, like, I kind of just do it that way. And it's just basically Microsoft forced me to completely change the way I do things, because I just couldn't handle not having the whole thing there. But so now they're bringing it back, and everyone's really excited. And I'm like, I like the way I do things now. I don't care.
It sounds like you are considering Future Paul, like that system.
Right. Well, past Paul made this decision. It seems to be working for me. It was nice that he was looking out for me.
All right. What Windows developer news do we have this week?
Yeah, so obviously there was a ton of developer news. I've got Visual Studio as one of the picks. I mean, they released a new version of Visual Studio at the show. They released a new version of Visual Studio Preview at the show. But they released Visual Studio for Mac went into general release, general availability at the show. That was a big stuff. We talked about that last week. But one of the things I was most excited about last week, because I've spent a ton of time playing with this kind of stuff, is something called Xamarin Live Player. And the Xamarin technologies are a way in Visual Studio on Windows to develop apps that run on Windows 10, Android, and iOS. And they're native apps. It's not like Java where kind of a weird shell on top of something, and it's not a pseudocode or whatever. It literally targets each of these environments using the underlying developer tools to create native apps using native widgets and all that kind of stuff. And you can do it all from one place. It's pretty cool. To date, one of the problems with this is, if you think about how this might work on a PC, you can obviously develop Windows apps on Windows. That works great. You can develop Android apps on Windows because we have virtual machines that work through Visual Studio. You can deploy the apps to the virtual machine. You can plug in a device and that will work. But if you wanted to do it to iOS, it's a very locked down environment. And so what you have to have is a Mac that's on your home network that's configured correctly for the right kind of remote access. It has to be configured correctly with Xamarin, and it has to be configured correctly with Xcode, which is Apple's developer environment. And basically what happens is Visual Studio hands off the software code for that version of the app, pushes it over the network to Xcode. It compiles it and it runs. Apple has their own virtual machines for iOS on the Mac. And it's just this kind of complicated onboarding process, and it's just a lot of work. In fact, I've never once actually gotten all of that to work correctly. I've gotten parts of it to work. So Microsoft announced something called the Xamarin Live Player at the show. And the point behind this thing is it's a way to deploy Android and iOS apps to Windows into devices that are plugged in through the USB port to the computer. So in other words, we can get rid of the Mac And we're gonna make our apps in the same solution that work across, you know, Windows, iOS, and or Android. We're gonna hit debug, you know, we're gonna debug or deploy the apps to the devices, and then they'll run on the devices. Like, you don't have to have a Mac anymore. And that sounded really exciting. The issue is you actually still need a Mac. So the way that I described it the week of the show, because I was just basing it on what they had said during the keynote, was what I just described. The way it actually works is everything I just described does work, but when it becomes time to do some more advanced things, or to actually deploy it to the store, in other words, you want to submit it to Apple so that they can potentially put it into the App Store, you actually have to have the Mac at that point. You will still need to have a Mac. And so the advantage of Xamarin Live Player is that it lets you get up and running more quickly than was possible like 2 weeks ago. Because, you know, you're going to have to get the Mac in there eventually. But you can actually get started. If you just have an iPhone, you can plug it into your PC and you can get going developing these apps using Xamarin, which is really exciting. And you can see the app running on your phone, which is really cool. And that was something you couldn't do before. More advanced things, again, or submitting it to Apple. Still going to have a Mac. That's just a limitation of that environment. So Microsoft actually clarified this in a blog post on their site. And I went back and looked what I wrote, and I was sort of horrified to discover that I'd kind of contributed to the confusion, because I wrote, like, I figured this was, you know, I was basing it on what they said, but I was mistaken to do so.
Fake news.
Fake news. Yeah, fake. That's me. Fake news. Yeah, fake news. It's fake sad. Developer news.
Well, have you tried it? I'm looking at the iTunes app for the Xamarin Live Player. There's only two customer reviews, and they are not good. One star. Apparently, the app doesn't pair with Visual Studio, and that's what Univ Hack says. And Mike Bates says it does not work at all.
Yeah, it sounds about right.
But that's the iOS app. So, yeah, I mean, I've
been traveling, so I haven't had a chance to try this. I've used Xamarin, so I've been using Xamarin, and we on my site had a Xamarin challenge, in fact, where we gave away two Surface Studios to people who were learning how to use Xamarin. I mean, aside from Llama's Xamarin Live Player, the Xamarin technology is really exciting. In the most recent release of Visual Studio, they're integrated in. They're not a separate thing. And, you know, if you've been using Visual Studio for years, you know, you can go file new and say, I want to make a Windows app, I want to do this. And you can create these cross-platform apps now that literally are multi-app solutions, where there's a version for Windows, a version for iOS, a version for Android, and you can share code. And it's really, really sophisticated, and it's really, really neat. But if you wanted to do the iOS part of it, you had that extra complexity. So I've never successfully done it, like, completely from end to end. And so I'm hoping that this will solve that problem. But I haven't tried. I haven't been able to try. I've been gone, you know, for almost 3 weeks.
Well, one can hope.
Yep.
Do we have any other news before we get to tips and picks? And I have a few listener questions. All right. Mm-hmm. Well, we will get to your questions. And I want to thank our sponsor for the show, Cloudflare. Now, you've heard of Cloudflare. You've heard Leo talk about it. We've interviewed some of the best people at Cloudflare to talk to them about it. Cloudflare is helping more than 6 million websites, apps, APIs, and other companies use Cloudflare services. And you can too. They're on a mission to help build a better internet. And Windows Weekly is brought to you by Cloudflare. Cloudflare makes your site or your app faster, safer, and more reliable, so you can stop worrying about slow loading page times, downtime, or getting hacked. Cloudflare is incredibly easy to use, and sign up takes less than 5 minutes. Cloudflare has a global network of over 115 data centers that cache your content and move it closer to visitors. Their web optimization features speeds up your code and makes it mobile responsive. End-to-end, Cloudflare speeds up every request to your site with performant DNS, caching, content optimization, load balancing, and more. Make your site, your app, or your API more secure. Now, Cloudflare doesn't only provide DDoS protection. Their web application firewall is powered by a massive IP reputation that updates for all users. Cloudflare's 24/7 security team is constantly watching for new vulnerabilities and deploying real-time protection, so they're there when you need them. You can avoid cloud provider lock-in no matter what you choose for your cloud compute. AWS, Azure, Google Cloud, a combination of public, hybrid, Cloudflare works with all of them. Using Cloudflare gives your business the option to use more than one cloud provider, so you don't get locked into any of them. flat pricing for everyone if you're hit with a DDoS attack, or if your site suddenly experiences a surge in legitimate traffic, you pay the same amount. So you don't have to worry about saying something or doing something amazing and having people rush to your site. Your site will stay up and you pay the same amount. Plans range from free, $20 a month, $200 a month, and custom plans for enterprise. Cloudflare is offering you, TWiT listeners, a free online chat session with one of their top support engineers to answer any of your questions. Visit cloudflare.com/TWiT to sign up today. That's cloudflare.com/TWiT. And we thank Cloudflare for their support of Windows Weekly. All right. You have a tip of the week, Paul, about Skype. I need some Skype tips. What's your tip?
Right. I wanted to apologize first for not having a bear pick, but I've been doing kind of a low-carb thing, so you're going to have to wait for Mary Jo. I bet she comes back with some Japanese beers, perhaps.
Oh, good.
for next time, or for 2 weeks from now. Yeah, so over the past year, I've been engaged in kind of a Chinese water torture thing with Skype, where you know, just because of the nature of this app, it's required. You know, we use Skype for Windows Weekly, and you guys do for everything on Twitter, I guess. And we use it for work as well. And it's kind of this essential thing, but we also kind of hate it because it's really intrusive and annoying, and it doesn't always work well, and, you know, on and on and on. But they added a feature last year to the web, which was just unbelievable, where if you had OneDrive, .com or Outlook.com open in a web browser, Skype could notify you there in addition to the desktop that you might have. And so if you picture, you know, me at home and I have my web browser open, because I actually prefer to use web clients for both of those things, Skype would ring in both of those tabs. It would ring on my desktop. Sometimes the universal Windows platform version of the app would also pop up. And then, of course, my various devices would all start ringing. And then because it was Skype, you would actually answer the call, but it would still keep ringing on certain devices and so forth. Anyway, you understand the problem. So Skype becomes this annoyance, and it becomes a huge problem. But the biggest thing on the web was that they added this feature without adding the ability to turn off notifications, at least on my iPhone. If I don't want to hear sounds or if I don't want to see the pop-up, I can say, I don't want that, turn it off. They added this feature to the web without providing the way to turn it off. And so I complained about this for many months. And finally, late last year, they provided a little UI just to turn it off. And so that enabled me to actually use these web interfaces again and leave them open and not worry about it, because before it became such an annoyance, I used to just shut them down all the time. So actually, that was enough for me. I was actually really happy about that. But this week, they're making another change, and they're actually breaking down that on or off switch into four different switches. And so what they have now are different switches for chat and for incoming call notifications, and then for sounds related to each. And so in other words, instead of everything on off, you might want to get incoming call notifications only. You may want to get incoming call notification sounds only, or some combination of those things, and then some combination of chat notification and chat notification sounds as well. So this one just came out of the blue. I suspect there are other people that provide feedback to Skype about the things they're doing wrong, and I guess they're listening. So that's cool. So that's just a nice one. Just so you know, there's not going to be any indication that this changed, but if you use this thing and use it on the web, you're going to want to know that that capability is either there right now or soon will be. And so that's cool.
By the way, I have to say your Skype looks great right now from New Orleans.
What's... Yeah, by the way, I was actually, so about 2 hours ago, I was freaking about this because I was thinking, I'm at this hotel in New Orleans. There's all kinds of conferences here, meeting lots of people. It's only Wi-Fi. And you know how hotel Wi-Fi can be. Mm-hmm. And I thought, like, Mary Jo's gone. So if my video doesn't work or if I can't connect somehow, like, I'm basically, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'd probably have to use my phone or something and just pray for the bit. Like, I was actually thinking, like, this might be the first time, like, this podcast doesn't happen because I don't have connectivity. But actually, yeah, it's worked out pretty well.
Yeah, it looks great.
The magic of Skype.
Magic of Skype. Well, it's funny, you know, we were talking earlier about the in-home devices. And, of course, Amazon just announced the Amazon Show that has the mm-hmm. screen. And, you know, now they have Amazon Calling, where you can, you know, make a video call with someone else who happens to have this device. And it's like everyone that day was just like, isn't this going to be amazing? It's like the video calling we've always wanted. And it's like Skype. it.
Well, but you know, it's interesting. I saw someone even make the comparison that Amazon has finally figured out a replacement for the landline, and I'm like, guys, what are you talking about? We've had, you know, people FaceTime all the time too. It's not just Skype, right? But I think that, again, you know, Amazon is kind of a surprising company, and the prevalence of these devices in people's homes, and then, you know, we'll see how the one with the video screen goes. But it's actually such a great idea. And it really does speak to the problem with Microsoft's kind of lack of strategy with the home, because, you know, that Harman Kardon speaker, for example, doesn't have a screen. So they're attacking a problem that Amazon attacked 2 years ago. And Amazon is moving forward to the next thing. And that's the late to market issue right there. That's a great example.
Yeah. And if they could have had a device that you could Skype with or Skype to, you know, I guess Google announced today that the Google Home, you'll be able to call people's phones. So they, of course.
Mm-hmm. Same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. They use the example of someone's mom, of course. Always throw the mom under the bus. The mom is always the technically incompetent one. Well, look, now you can call your mom and she doesn't need to download an app, because no moms know how to download apps, of course.
Yeah. My mother actually does have an Alexa device, an Echo. And, she's not quite blind, but she's basically blind. And obviously, like, that kind of voice interface is really key for her. Like, mm-hmm. that works. I mean, in her case, having a video screen probably wouldn't help too much. Although it might help people on the other end if they wanted to see her and see how she was doing. But, I agree with you. It's a little unfair, but it's, there are so many normal people that don't know anything about technology, and that kind of thing's is great for those people.
Mm-hmm. That's true. You mentioned also an Xbox backward compatibility sale. What's that all about?
Yeah. So on the Xbox One, there's a feature called backward compatibility that allows certain Xbox 360 games to play on that console. It's an especially cool feature if you own these games digitally, of course, because then you can just install them right on the hard drive. There are hundreds and hundreds of games available now, including some really high-profile games, like most of the Call of Duty games, for example, all of the Dead Space games, Red Dead Redemption, the Grand Theft Auto 4, etc. So this is a great feature. It's one of the big benefits of the Xbox platform. This week, I think it runs through the 22nd, which is what, Tuesday probably, or Monday. They have 275 Xbox 360 games on sale. They're all backward compatibility, meaning if you have an Xbox One, they will work on that platform as well. And the prices are up to 75% off. That sounds awesome. But the thing is, if you actually look at the list and you look at the, like, the really high profile games, those games are almost all 67 to 75% off. It's not like there's one game that's 75% and the rest are like 12% off. All the Assassin's Creed games are 67% off. All the BioShock games, Borderlands games, Call of Duty games, it goes on and on and on. So, if you're an Xbox gamer, you know, this is the time to kind of look through that list. And a lot of these games are really fantastic. This isn't like garbage. Like, these are really, really good games. And so this is a great way to kind of bulk up your library if you don't own these games. Or maybe you own them on disc and you just want to get them electronically for a couple of bucks. Like, it's not a bad way to go.
Well, we got a question on Twitter, and I apologize if you already talked about this 2 weeks ago when they introduced Windows 10S. I feel like this news, the news that it restricts your use of the Chrome browser, that you'll only be able to use the Edge browser on 10S, that's the special version. We got a question. Donald on Twitter asks, he says, Windows 10S restricts the use of the Chrome browser, which is a deal breaker for me. I really don't like the Edge browser. What are your thoughts?
I also do not like the Edge browser. I understand your concern. We did talk to Microsoft about this last week, and, you know, there's kind of an interesting back and forth there. Terry Myerson has told me explicitly that Google is welcome to bring Chrome to the store, but the Chrome he's talking about is a Chrome that adheres to the Microsoft Store guidelines, which require those apps to use the Edge rendering engine and some other technologies. And so if you think about the way that Chrome works on iOS, it would be like that. So it's kind of like not real Chrome, but it's a Chrome shell around the Safari rendering engine, essentially. But the important part of that experience is that what you're getting is cross-device sync of, you know, your bookmarks, your passwords, the form-filled data, and so forth. I think that's what people are really looking for, but I also think that you can make a case where it makes sense for Google to make that app on iOS because there's so many users there. It doesn't necessarily make sense for Apple or for Google, sorry, to split the development of Chrome into two different projects, one of which only works on this smaller user base that's on Windows 10. And like I said, not necessarily a very engaged audience and so forth. The flip side of this argument would be, Chrome is an important app. We know it is literally the number one most often used desktop application on Windows. Maybe it would behoove Microsoft to give Chrome an exception and say, we know that you guys are doing your own sandboxing and stuff. We know that it's a safe app along, some guideline, maybe. We'll let you in the store anyway. We'll just let you use the desktop bridge. We'll make the exception for you. You can put your app in the store. Maybe Microsoft should do that. I've made this argument. I think that is what Microsoft should do. When I asked Microsoft about this, it wasn't Terry Myerson in this case. It was just a guy I know from Microsoft. let me see if I can get this exact phrase, but it was something along the lines of this would require Terry to be benevolent with Google, and Terry is not feeling very benevolent right now. I think was the way he said it. Something like that. It was almost that exact quote. I don't know what to say. I think Windows S is a little behind the eight ball in the sense that it's a chicken egg problem. And I agree that this is the future for Windows, we need to get there. It's important. There are a lot of issues with Win32, but you also have to accept the reality of the situation, which I was just praising Microsoft for earlier, by the way, and understand that Win32 apps are what people actually are using. So they're not willing to compromise the security, the performance, the reliability of the system to allow Chrome into the store in its current state. And so that's kind of where we're at.
Well, I saw another question scroll by quickly for Joy in mm-hmm. the chat room, asked if you recommend that he or she breaks out his old XP PC and updates, even though it doesn't connect to the internet anymore.
I get if you don't connect to the internet anymore, you just connecting to the internet could give you this ransomware. Maybe you should just not connect it to the internet. No, I guess not. The other thing it just occurred to me too. And Win10s, remember, if you opt into this system between now and the end of the year, you get Windows 10 Pro for free, right? So if Windows 10s is not going to work for you, and maybe you want to buy that new Surface laptop, for example, you're going to get Windows 10 Pro for free, so you'll be able to run Chrome. You could also do something goofy on such a system. Anyone could do this. You could install Windows 10 Pro or bring a new PC up to speed, and you could install Chrome. And then you could go into settings and flip that switch like they have on the map that says, don't only allow store apps, right? So in other words, we have this one non-store app, Chrome, and then everything else we're only going to do store. I mean, you could make that decision that's like, I'm only going to eat vegetables, but I'll have one cookie, after dinner or something, I guess. It's something anyone could do, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Virgil in the chat room keeps asking a question that involves a Guardians of the Galaxy spoiler alert, so I'm not going to ask it. So you're going to
start. Oh, because you can't say what the – is it the Zune thing?
Yeah.
I am aware of it.
Have you seen the movie?
No, but I'm aware of that. I'm the type of person – I don't care about spoilers, so I don't want to say eagerly, but I will go, right now the big thing is this Alien Covenant movie. Like I want to know everything that's going on. I will go see the movie. I want to see the movie, but I don't care you can't ruin it for me. Like I want to know everything.
Interesting. I am a complete information blackout person. Like, you just say, you just like, if I see your expression, I wasn't looking when I asked you if you'd seen Guardians of the Galaxy. If I see an expression, it could ruin the whole movie. I don't know what that says.
No, by the way, that's probably more normal, frankly. So don't feel bad about that.
Okay. All right. So Visual Studio 2017 version 15.2. What do we need to know about that?
Yeah, well, just so I have I usually do, like an app pick and a tip.
Oh, right. I missed your app pick. Sorry.
Yeah. No, it's okay. Because Mary Jo's gone, I just have a few of each. Okay. So on the app pick, this week I just picked OneNote because, we were talking earlier, they updated it on iOS and it's nice. And I don't know if you brought up the show notes on it or whatever, but they've done a nice kind of job with it. They've made it more consistent with the app on Windows 10. And it's a little more obvious if you look at the iPad version of the app, because it's actually possible to see all the different columns at one time Whereas because of the way the screen works on a phone, you just kind of go through one column at a time. But it's, you know, it's just kind of a, you know, it's just a nice kind of pretty looking thing they've done. So there's that. Last week at Build, Microsoft released the new version of Visual Studio. So they're still using the year names on this product, which is confusing, but it's Visual Studio 2017. The version is 15.2. So if you look, go back to last year, obviously the first version that came out was Visual Studio 15. Now we're up to 15.2. So there have been two, you know, feature updates since then. This one's actually kind of a big one because it brings back two features that they took out of the initial release because they weren't ready yet. One of them is related to Python, and the other one is related to, not TypeScript, I can't remember off the top of my head, but there are two. The Python was really the bigger of the two. So in some ways, this is sort of the version of Visual Studio 2017 that they've already always, you know, intended to ship. Not to mention the fact that we get all those additional features like the Xamarin Live Player that I was talking about earlier. There's also, if you want to live on the edge, and I don't think many developers do, but if you do, Microsoft is also now making preview versions of Visual Studio. And so you can get version 15.3 in preview right now. I'm actually not aware of what new features are in that version, but on my desktop computer at home, I actually have both. You can run both side by side. I actually don't see any huge advantage to doing that. But, you know, if you're into that kind of thing, it's kind of like the insider program for Visual Studio. And then finally, I think this happened last week as well. Opera released a new version of their web browser. Now, they're for Windows. This is obviously kind of an also-ran in the browser world. But Opera's actually kind of an interesting choice because Opera uses the Chromium rendering engine. So it's basically Chrome without the Google stuff. And you could kind of make the case that that's not such a horrible idea. I actually do use Chrome. I like Chrome. But, I use Google services. I'm not worried about it. But, I mean, I know a lot of people have issues with Google. So this is an interesting choice, and in this version in particular, let me just bring this thing up because I want to make sure I get this right. They support three integrated chat solutions. Right now it's Facebook Messenger, WhatsApp, and Telegram. Apparently they're going to allow other services in as well, but they work from this kind of sidebar, or you can have them be an overlay on the tab. And, you know, in this kind of world we're moving toward where we do a lot of stuff with web apps, this is something, you know, when I talk about progressive web apps, or I write about this stuff a lot, actually. You know, I've moved from a lot of native apps to web apps, and actually doing everything in a browser is kind of interesting. You know, they support a dark mode, which is something we have on Windows 10, and they also have just various improvements across the board, ad blocking, security, and performance, and so forth. But basically, what we're looking at here is a Chrome-based web browser that kind of has some cool features. And I think it was maybe a year ago or sometime last year that they were offering kind of a forward-leaning kind of project browser called Neon, where they were trying out different UIs and trying different features. And this product, this version of Opera 45, incorporates some of those features, which, including, by the way, that integrated messenger thing. So if you're, you know, if you want to use Chrome, but you don't want to use Chrome's maker, you know, you might want to look at Opera. It's something to think about.
I've always liked Opera, and I do find myself sticking, I mean, I use Chrome almost exclusively, but I do find myself just, yeah, doing most things in a browser, like wondering why I couldn't just move to a Chromebook.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, you know, one of the progressive web app things that was kind of cool that Microsoft showed off was Twitter is a good example of a service that offers a progressive web app version of the Surface. And so the Twitter web app compared to the Android native app, they're not literally identical, but they're almost exactly identical. They're so close that you'd never notice the difference. And that's where web apps have gone. You know, people like ask me all the time, you know, what email app do you use? Do you use the mail app in Windows 10? Do you use Outlook, you know, 27, whatever we're on? What are we on? 2016, sorry. No, I hate those apps. In my case, I use the Google Inbox web app, and I pin it to the taskbar on Windows 10 because that's one of the cool things you can do in Chrome. Mm.
And do you use Google Inbox on your iPhone, or do you use Outlook on your iPhone?
I go back and forth, but I've found that, you know, it's kind of an internal debate because Outlook on iOS works like Outlook on the PC, where it offers everything in this one app. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a new way of doing things on mobile. And it is kind of a whack-a-mole thing where you're going in and out. But I do kind of like the separation. I like having email be its own thing. You know, if you think about getting a notification on a mobile app, imagine it could, that notification could be like a calendar event or an email, and maybe only one of those is actually pressing, and I might not want to go in and look to see what it is and then discover it's not the thing I care about. I sort of like the fact that inbox is a thing, and then Google Calendar can be this other thing. Mm. And that's, but I go back and forth because I really do like Outlook for iOS or Android, actually. I mean, they're both really great, but I don't know. It's kind of a, both of them are on all of my devices, but I think I would say more often than not, I probably use inbox.
Yeah, I am a big inbox user, and I've been trying an app called Newton, which I don't mm-hmm. think is on Windows.
I think it's iOS only. Yeah.
And it's great, and I can use it to check my email with my Amazon Echo, which is why I first started trying it.
That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
I like the inbox UI. Like in fact, even Gmail to me looks antiquated. You know, mm-hmm. There's something about inbox. Maybe it's just the color because they're very similar in a way, but there's nothing extraneous going on, right? Mm-hmm. When I look at an email, I want to read it. I might want to reply to it. And then I want to do something with it. I'm going to archive it or I'm going to delete it. And that's what inbox does.
Yeah. Or snooze it, right? I mean, you can
or snooze.
Yeah. That's what I do too. And I love that inbox has those little built-in, yes, sounds great, or, you know, just it knows.
Smart replies.
Yeah, the smart replies. It knows how I'm going to respond. Sometimes they are hilarious, but often they work, just, you know.
Yep. Yeah. And those are great on a phone, too, because sometimes, you know, even like at a show like this, you're walking down a hall, and I don't want to stop and type. You can just hit that one thing, and you're mm-hmm. good to go for a little while.
Right. Sometimes they're nicer than me, too. Like, someone has before said they're too sick to come into work, or their child is sick, and, you know, I'm getting ready to respond something, and the smart reply is like, I hope she feels better. I'm like, oh, right, that's what I meant to say. Thank you, Google.
truly smart replies would adapt to you as a personality. Like, so mine would all be, like, snarky and terrible. And like the smart reply would just be like awful reply.
Right. You know? Right. Like when I emailed you earlier and I said, you know, so it's just the two of us, you would have, Google would have known you were going to say something snarky. Yep.
Right. Well, actually, my number one response to everything would be yes, comma, sorry. Like, yeah, sorry. This is what you got.
Well, Paul, thank you so much. Did we miss anything? Did I leave anything out?
I was nervous. There wasn't a lot of stuff, but actually, it feels like it was pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we did. We don't need Mary Jo. She can stay for one more week, and then we need her back.
I would. Yeah, I'm just glad the Wi-Fi and it worked. You know, I'm pleasantly surprised.
Yes. Well, next week will be you and Leo and Brad.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I'd ask Brad if he could do one or both of these shows. And we're both here at the same show. We came here for VeeamON, and he's a lot more heavily involved. And, of course, well, I had to do this anyway. So he's been busy all day working down at the booth and interviewing people and everything. So, yeah, he couldn't do it today. But I think he'll be able to do it next week.
Awesome. Well, I'll set you free and into back to the conference, back to New Orleans. Thank you so much for all of your, for laying all of your Windows knowledge on us. Go to Therat.com, follow Paul on Twitter. Anything else we should know? Anywhere else we should go?
Let me see what Smart Reply says. It says, yes, I can tell you where to go.
No, all right. Well, if you're in New Orleans, go say hi to Brad, not to Paul, because he doesn't want to talk to you. But go say hi to Brad. Yep. Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching Windows Weekly. Windows Weekly records every Wednesday around 11 a.m. Pacific. And, of course, you can get it whenever you want at twit.tv/WW, where you can download it. Subscribe to the show so you are the first to get it. I am Megan Maroney. I'm on Twitter at Megan Maroney. And you can find me on Tech News Today every weekday, Monday through Friday, and on iOS Today every Monday. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a good day.